easier to believe in an infinite number of parallel universes than in God? Carol replied, Because if there are so many universes, the odds are one will win the cosmic lottery and possess all the insanely fine-tuned requirements needed to create us human beings who get pregnant and hungry. It's almost done. But the multiverse is just a theory there's no real evidence for. And even if they do come up with equations for it, they still can't prove God didn't create it. So we're back to square one. In some universe, Carol said impatiently, we're already eating. Wrong. I flipped the ham and cheese omelet onto a serving platter. As you pointed out, the multiverse theory makes it possible for one universe to accidentally create us. So even if parallel universes are real, we only exist here and now. While we were eating, Carol observed suspiciously, You look exceptionally happy this morning.
Don't I always look happy these days?
Did you have another lucid dream?
No.
I mean, I didn't realize I was dreaming, but it was as real as being awake. Steve calls these semi-lucid dreams. I went back to eating. After about a minute, Carol sipped her tea and said lightly, So you're not going to tell me about it?
Nope, not today. I can't. It was too special, too intimate, too incredible.
I get it. Did you have sex with Steve in it?
No,
I frowned at her, and then felt compelled to add, I believe I dreamed of Jesus. Outside, the call to prayer began broadcasting through the city, but fortunately the windows were closed and the air conditioner was purring contentedly, so we could still hear ourselves think. Making an effort to sound casual, Carol finished her omelet before she asked, So, what did Jesus look like?
He was beautiful.
But he didn't look like in the movies. He wasn't wearing a robe and walking around barefoot. He was wearing a white shirt and pants with black edges. Jesus is God, which means he's timeless. And it only makes sense he would appear to me in a way that, I don't know, in a way that appeals to me personally. And yet, before I went to sleep, I prayed to God to see him in a lucid dream, the way he had looked when he was here on earth. So, I don't know. What happened in the dream? I described my dream to her, which was easy now that I felt she truly wanted to hear about it. Her response was an eloquent, Wow. The call to prayer had ended, and the apartment was blessedly quiet, yet also alive with an intensely soothing energy, as I literally felt another young woman reading the Gospels in a different room, but in the same space. A girl from another culture, another religion, whose native language I could only speak a few words of, but with whom I had something transcendent in common. We had both dreamed of Jesus Christ. So it's true, Carol said quietly. You're not just going to church to please Steve. You're really becoming a Christian. In your heart. And poor Liba. I feel like I'm betraying her mother by letting her hide in here reading the Bible. Mary, this could get really ugly. For her, especially. But it also might be bad for us. Specifically for you. Because Hamoud and his family are employed by the owner of this apartment. And if I get into trouble with them somehow, it might pose a problem to you staying here after I move out. And then what will you do? She didn't mention the guest room in her new luxury high-rise apartment in Mahdi. I felt hurt, but only for a moment. Because, of course, I couldn't blame her for not wanting me to stay with her and Simon right after they were married. So I said bravely, We'll cross that bridge if we come to it. After all, that's nothing. A minor glitch in comparison to what's in store for Liba if she decides to follow Jesus. Mary, I feel like the magic pattern is spinning a web around me, and there's no use trying to escape it because it just keeps tightening. Her tone and the fact that her tea was getting cold meant she was thinking very seriously about something. I want my child to grow up with an open mind, but that's not enough. Steve said something that night we shared a blanket in Amos's Mastaba. He quoted some Christian writer, I think Chesterton, who said something to the effect that merely having an open mind isn't enough, because the reason for having an open mind is the same reason we open our mouth, to close it again on something solid. I want my child to have a solid foundation on which to stand on, which is why I want Steve to be the godfather, because I don't mind baby learning about God and Jesus through him. But you know, Mary, that much as I love my parents, I could never stand going to their Presbyterian church and being around all those self-righteous, boring, opinionated, judgmental, gossiping, superficial. I was there, Carol. I know perfectly well how you feel about organized religion of any kind. And I felt the same way until I began lucid dreaming and met Steve. Although technically, I met him first. He was the one who turned on the lights for me in the mastaba where I first dreamed of Jesus. The symbolic significance of this action just now hitting me, I smiled in wonder. You interrupted me, Mary. Sorry. The point is, I'm glad you and Steve will be around to balance Simon's atheism. And what are you planning to do, Carol? Just stand around and watch? You still believe in the magic pattern, don't you?
Of course I do. I just don't know what's behind it yet. And I'm happy that way, at least for now.
Good enough. I got up and began clearing the table. For now. I whispered, "Oh God, I missed you so much." Steve returned my embrace with as much warmth and fervor as I was putting into mine. He didn't tease me by saying,
"But we just saw each other last night,"
or anything else trivial. It made being with him, touching him, inhaling the unique scent of his skin, just absorbing his presence, almost painfully pleasurable. And when his mouth opened against mine, I knew at once this kiss was different and dangerous. I felt my already weak resolve slipping and succumbing without a fight to an undertow of desire so powerful, I literally felt the ground slip out from beneath my feet, because he was carrying me somewhere. I both prayed and was afraid he was taking me into his bedroom. It was the familiar couch I landed on, but still in his arms and deep in our kiss, it didn't feel any safer. I couldn't wait another minute to feel his entire body naked against mine, much less weeks or months or longer. Impossible! There was no reason to wait. Tugging his shirt hungrily out of his pants, I slipped my hands beneath it and caressed his firm belly before moving up to his smooth, hard chest. He was still kissing me. He didn't stop me. And hope spiking with my need, I dared to reach down and free the top button of his pants. One of his hands found mine and gently but firmly raised it to his shoulder. A few seconds later, we surfaced from the kiss, breathless survivors of the riptide of desire to which I had been more than willing to sacrifice our efforts to do things the right way. My body had cried, "To hell with that! I want him now!" And I still did. My heart was pounding, and I was so turned on, every good and rational thought short-circuited before it could even form. I could manage only the blind, soundless cry, "This isn't fair!" Steve said,
"I'm sorry, Mary."
But I couldn't tell if he meant he was sorry we couldn't just have sex now like normal people, or if he was sorry he had almost lost control, and, as a consequence, permitted me to do so as well. But I sensed he didn't regret the temporary discomfort that resisting temptation was causing him, because I had brushed his crotch with my hand and felt how hard he was. The sensation of his buried erection had been as reassuring as it was thrilling, which meant, and I was totally ashamed of myself for this concern, he didn't have a physical problem he was covering up with piety.
"Mary, I get the feeling you're trying to reassure yourself of something. So, here."
Taking one of my hands, he shifted his position on the couch and opened his legs as he pressed my palm down between them. I gasped. He whispered in my ear,
"Feel that? I want you. And even after I take your virginity, it's going to be a while before you can handle all of me." He reclaimed my hand and pulled me up off the couch as he stood. My Christian boyfriend had just talked dirty to me? Would wonders never cease? He hadn't said any dirty words, and I knew by his tone, and because he was who he was, that he had been stating a fact, but in a totally hot way. And although it turned me on so much I was incapable of coherent speech for at least 10 minutes afterward, it had also soothed my restlessness by eliminating that particular anxiety.
Mary, I've seen too many couples jump into bed and then into living together because they mistook a powerful infatuation for true love.
As he spoke, he took a few steps into the kitchen to pour us both cups of water.
The former eventually wears off. But by then, financial reasons for staying together, along with comfortable habits and routines, make it seem natural to start thinking about marriage. Problem is, when you're already living with someone who might not really be the one, you're missing out on the chance to meet the person who could truly be the love of your life. Living together makes it hard to escape superficially comfortable and even affectionate relationships that might become deeply unsatisfying and lead to all sorts of problems on every level.
Thank you, I said, accepting the glass he handed me. I knew a girl in high school who said she never wanted to get a divorce, so as soon as she turned 18, she moved in with her boyfriend to make sure it would really work between them before they actually got married.
But that way, you miss out on all the pleasures of the courtship and proposal.
With his thumb and forefinger, he tilted my head up and obliged me to meet his eyes.
Not to mention how much less exciting the honeymoon will be.
When he looked at me that way, I really didn't care what he was saying, but my heart began racing as my mind caught and my soul held onto for all it was worth that one key word, proposal. The closest I had ever come to the sacrament of reconciliation was watching Stephen Colbert's Midnight Confessions. I had also enjoyed watching a few movies in which a handsome priest fell in love with the pretty young woman confessing her sinful desires to him in the intimate darkness of a confessional. That was very much how I felt with Steve sometimes when we talked. Opening my heart and soul up to him was easy and exciting, but the thought of quickly trying to sum up things for a stranger while other people waited their turn outside the booth was impossible. So it was a huge relief when my boyfriend told me he had arranged for me to meet with his own priest in private and face-to-face in his office.
I've already filled him in on how you came to the place where you are now,
he assured me.
It will be a conversation, during which you can ask him and tell him anything the Spirit prompts you to.
The big, scary reconciliation that had been hanging over my head like a spiritual guillotine, and during which I talked my head off, turned out to be totally awesome. I was shocked when Steve informed me afterward that I had spent over an hour with the priest, whose sense of humor had surprised and relaxed me, so much so that, before I knew it, I was simply being myself, which meant inundating him with my thoughts and feelings and questions. But instead of appearing overwhelmed, or impatient, or indifferent, or like wishing he was somewhere else, typical reactions I was accustomed to with my parents and sometimes even with Carol, he listened intently, sometimes smiling, but not in a superior way. Nothing I said seemed to surprise him, and he didn't once lecture me, but occasionally, when I paused for breath, he said something or asked me a question that helped me make sense of everything in a whole new light and that thrilled me with its powerful clarity. I left the church annex, where Father John had his little office, not only absolved of my sins, but with his permission to receive the body and blood of Christ through Holy Communion before I was officially confirmed. I was relieved to have jumped that hurdle, but even more surprised by how much I had enjoyed what I had feared would be a very awkward effort. As Steve and I walked away from the church, my step was light, and I didn't stumble, because I felt my feet were planted on something truly solid now. The priest had told me God was blessing me through my dreams.
A dream that comes from God, he had said, bears good fruit, filling you with love for him and for his word. Dreams sent from the enemy have the opposite effect. The Spirit gives us all unique gifts, and it is clear to me, Mary, that God is blessing you through your dreams. But stay alert. Never let yourself become proud of them, as if they are some special power you possess, and which make you special, a seductive illusion planted by the enemy. In truth, what you and so many other people are experiencing in these times is a manifestation of God's mercy. In a world so filled with noise, Christ is whispering to our souls in our dreams and leading us safely home to him. Pay no heed to any Christians you might meet in the future who believe dreams happened only in the Bible, and we don't need them anymore now that we have Christ's word to guide us, and that's all we need, and it's sinful to think otherwise. Even worse are believers who think all dreams come from the devil. There is a great deal of opinionated ignorance in the world, including the church. For all institutions run by mortal men are flawed and subject to corruption, but the church is the bride of Christ, who said to his disciples, "For where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I among them." So listen to the Lord who lives in your heart, Mary, and keep your eyes on him, no matter what people say, for no one has the right to limit how God reaches out to us.
Chapter 14. The Palace of Arts is located in the Nile Grand Hall, one of the supremely modern buildings spread out across a large area of wide boulevards lined with trees on the island of Gezira. Also nearby is the Museum of Egyptian Modern Art. In my opinion, the palace's two exhibition halls were much lovelier than the paintings currently hanging in them, but a smile was effortlessly painted on my face as I followed Carol around, who was happy enough for both of us. But my smile wilted in the second museum when I saw way too many ugly distortions, some bordering on the psychotic, of ancient Egyptian originals. What my friend thought of them remained a mystery, because she rarely spoke when surrounded by the works of other artists, which I found myself thinking were the stained glass windows of her personal church. Yet it seemed to me that too many of these so-called artists had nothing truly and timelessly meaningful to express, but were more interested in their highly questionable talent, judged in great part by how much money people would pay to own their work, which was in large part determined by art critics who were paid to write reviews based on what was trending, for some reason or other. I had never been so happy to see Hamoud as I was that afternoon. During the drive home, I sat alone in the back seat, babysitting the carefully wrapped prints Carol had purchased for her new home. I wondered what Simon would think of them. I actually almost liked two of them myself, especially an oil and gold leaf on canvas depicting an Arabian Nights-style woman in soft but radiant colors, her veil forming the arch of an abstract palace washed with sky blue colors. But I couldn't quite figure out the stylized pink horse in the foreground, supporting what looked like a circular bronze shield over its chest. Did it represent the knight in shining armor who she longed to ride off into the sunset with? I had posed this question to Carol earlier, and she had replied, "Why does it have to mean anything? Can't it just be beautiful?" Familiar with that note in her voice, I had bitten back my response, which would have been, "How can something be beautiful, yet meaningless?" By the time we made it back to the apartment, I felt drained from so much interesting, original, innovative, revolutionary, postmodern, minimalist, constructivist, futuristic, etc., everything but meaningful art I had been surrounded by all day. I kept wondering who it was had said, "Beauty is truth, truth is beauty." And so the first words out of my mouth when Steve called me that evening were, "Hi! Who said, beauty is truth, truth is beauty?" Initially, the only answer I got was his laughter, which, as far as I was concerned, was beautiful as well as meaningful, since I didn't feel I could live without hearing it again and again forever. Turns out it was the poet John Keats, and the full quote was, "Beauty is truth, Truth is beauty. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know. Suddenly, I didn't feel tired anymore. Hanging up the phone, I yelled, Simon and Steve are on their way. I'm going to make us all dinner. From inside the bathroom, Carol yelled back, Great! I had always wondered what exactly Steve and Simon did all day in the little office generously accorded the Egyptologist since his discovery of a papyrus that had not just Egyptologists but also medical doctors excited. After dinner, I learned I was soon to find out. Carol had barely finished clearing the table. As chef, I was not expected to exert myself further. When Simon brought over his suitcase, flipped it open, and pulling out some papers, handed them to Steve, who then, to my surprise, passed them to me.
I've decided, Mary, Simon said, that my assistant is the one who needs an admin. You can look over the employment contract if you want to, but I think you can trust Steve, and me, of course. It's only part-time, and won't pay all that much, I'm afraid, but it's good enough. At least for now, since you can live in this apartment free of charge for at least another 5 months.
I didn't say anything. I wasn't looking at the papers. I was staring at Steve, who would soon, if I had understood Simon correctly, be my boss. No way! I wasn't getting this. It was too good to be true. I must have heard wrong. And Steve wasn't helping clarify matters by looking at me almost as if I was a stranger, being offered the position by our mutual employer, and it wasn't his place to say anything. Which I suppose it wasn't, and wondering if he felt comfortable with this development resulted in me just sitting there looking at him, and then at Simon, and then back again, like a dimwit, completely unqualified for the position.
And here.
Placing something on the table, Simon slid it over to me.
That's for you. It's all set to go. You'll just need to change the temporary password Steve used to set it up.
A small cry escaped me when looking down at the table. I saw a brand new phone lying before me in all its dark, shining glory. The look on my face inspired Simon to say sternly,
Please try and remember that this is a business phone, Mary, so keep the personal text to a minimum.
Considering the fact that the person I most wanted to talk to in the world was Steve, who I would soon be working for and with, that really wasn't going to be an issue. I realized then I had been enjoying the mystery of not knowing exactly where he was and what he was doing at every moment. Then again, it would be even better if I spent more of those moments without needing to wonder, because I knew exactly where he was, with me. I finally spoke. I don't know what to say, Simon. Thank you hardly seems adequate. May I please have a pen? I don't need to read the contract. I'm ready to sign, and I promise I'll work very hard. He slid a pen over to me.
I'm sure you will, Mary.
There wasn't a hint of sarcastic innuendo in his voice. All I heard in it was relief, which I felt to be very flattering for both Steve and me. I thought of that other contract I hadn't signed, the one from Richard, and the small part of me still wondering if I had done the right thing shriveled up and vanished like a decrepit vampire exposed to the sun rising on my new life in Egypt. I was still a little scared because I'd never had a job before, and I knew it wouldn't be easy suppressing how intensely attracted I was to Steve while we were in business mode. But I had no doubt it would all work out. So when do I start? I inquired politely, after I had signed all the papers and Simon had closed his leather suitcase on them, so that for a scary moment it resembled the jaws of a crocodile swallowing my freedom. Simon raised his eyebrow at Steve in a way that said all my questions were now in his hands.
Not for a few weeks, Mary. There are other logistics to iron out first. Until I say otherwise, you're still on vacation, so relax.
I grinned. Yes, sir.
If you call me that again,
my boyfriend and boss said almost fiercely,
I'll fire you. Technically, you can't do that, Steve. Simon sounded amused, since you both work for me. You'll have to settle for disciplining her in some way. Maybe only let her have bread and water for lunch for a few days. I'd be happy to add a uniform to your budget. You know, like the kind Catholic schoolgirls wear.
I suspected he was just getting started with possible Catholic-style methods Steve could use to discipline me. But just then Carol appeared, literally pulled him up out of his chair, and led him down the corridor to her room, undoubtedly to show him all the art prints she had bought for their new apartment, which left Steve and I gazing into each other's eyes. Leaning comfortably back in his chair, he rested his left hand on the table, and I needed no further encouragement to take it.
"Did you have a nice day?"
he asked. "It was okay. Carol had a great time, so I was happy." His expression did not alter. He was looking at me in an inscrutable way I found exciting, maybe because it made me nervous. "How was your day?" I countered.
"I was distracted."
"By what?"
"Thinking about you, Mary, of course."
"What were you thinking about me, Steve?"
"Lots of things. For example, I know your parents have given you permission to extend your stay here in Egypt because of Carol, and I was wondering if you had any idea when you planned to tell them about us. I want to meet them, but first they have to know I exist."
He smiled, but his eyes remained serious.
"Simon told me today that Carol's parents have decided not to visit until the baby is due."
"What? Last I heard, they didn't even know she was pregnant. No wonder she looks so relaxed and happy today. I thought it was just because she was surrounded by paintings." I supposed I shouldn't have been so surprised Carol hadn't shared this major newsflash with me. She always avoided the inevitable until the last possible moment, then impulsively got it over with and forgot to mention it.
"So, Mary, do you think your own parents will still want to spend Christmas in Cairo with you?"
"I doubt it."
"Wouldn't you like them to?"
"Not really," I admitted.
"You're not looking forward to introducing me to them?"
I couldn't be sure if he was teasing me or not, and thinking about it, I realized that my relief at my parents' continued distance was not flattering either to him or me. In fact, it was childish, a way of wanting to strike out on my own and be all grown up, while at the same time holding on to the comfort of not really being responsible for myself, because I still had unsuspecting parents to rescue me should things go badly. I looked down at my new phone and decided out loud, "I'll email them tomorrow."
"What will you say?"
"I'll tell them there's another infinitely more important reason I want to stay in Egypt."
"That's good."
He squeezed my hand.
"No need to tell them any more yet. And this way, it's entirely up to them if they want to spend Christmas with you here or not. I hope they do."
It's a bright sunny day, and I'm standing outside in a green field beside the car that brought us all here, because I'm not alone. I recognize my maternal grandfather, and the woman who appears beside him is his wife, my grandma. Now I notice my mother is standing next to me, and I point out to her that her deceased parents have come to visit us. Then she and I turn toward a large house across the street, and entering it, we start walking up a broad but short flight of white steps toward a spacious wooden landing lit by tall windows filled with blue sky. That's when I realize out loud, this is a dream. I get it now. Walking up the remaining steps ahead of me, Mom glances back at me, a curious little smile on her face that seems pleased yet wistful, as if she knows perfectly well this is a dream, but also knows she won't remember being here with me when she wakes in the morning. As we ascend to the second and main floor, I look out the windows in growing appreciation of the view. We're definitely in a dream neighborhood, because all the residences, which are close together yet also somehow command their own personal space, are a beautiful blend of a house and a church. Pausing to gaze out and down at them, I realize they are even more complex, a fascinating synthesis of a church, a house, a boat, a primitive sort of hut, still visible in the structure, and more. We reach the main floor of the residence, which is very spacious and eclectically but pleasingly furnished and decorated. I'm aware of several people, mostly men, standing in the living room facing me as I arrive. Looking around me, I declare, I'm going to call Steve. Is there a phone here? Turning left, I proceed into a more intimate adjoining space, searching for a phone. Everything is very real and detailed, and I'm thrilled when I spot a cordless phone standing on its charger on an elegant wooden table. Hurrying over to it, I pick it up. I don't know Steve's number by heart, so I decide to simply dial S-T-E-V-E with the strangely misty plastic rectangles on which I can just make out orange letters. As I wait for an answer, conscious of needing to keep studying my surroundings to avoid waking up, I look into a full-length mirror partially obscured by some furniture. I see myself as I am now. I'm even wearing the t-shirt I'm sleeping in. Then I hear a clicking sound, and a woman's automated voice informs me, "Your call cannot be completed as dialed." What? Really? Hanging up, I try again, focusing intently on pressing just the right rectangles to spell Steve's name, and this time a man's voice answers the phone. I cry, "Steve, this is Mary. I'm calling you from the dream space. This is a dream. We're dreaming." But the voice which I recognize now is not Steve's, replies kindly but firmly, "Steve is not available at this time." Admitting defeat, I hang up and walk out of the small room, disappointed but pleased I had the idea to call him. Heading deeper into the house, I follow two tall young men, who I recognize as my brothers, into a long, spacious, and radiantly lit room with a really high wall on the right and equally tall windows on the left. We're followed into the bedroom by several young women. These dream characters are all uniquely attractive individuals who don't resemble me at all, but there is no doubt in my mind and heart that we're all brothers and sisters. Watching them climb like children into bunk beds placed one over the other against a cathedral-high wall, my lucid curiosity sharpens into a question I voice out loud, "Who are you?" Turning their smiling faces toward mine, they all reply in a powerful, almost challenging chorus, "We are who you are." Their response breaks through my heart in a wave of joyful recognition. Their response makes perfect, amazing sense. And as I leave the room, walking deeper into the beautiful, luminous residence with its cathedral windows and dimensions, I repeat to myself, "We are who you are. We are who you are," wondering if I should wake up so I can write this down. Instead, I proceed toward the back of the house, where the long corridors are not as well lit. Then I hear an invisible presence inquire if I plan to go witness my brother's drills, and I understand that weapons, perhaps swords, are involved in what's going on outside the doors I see now. Thinking this would be fun, I walk outside, at which point I can feel that I'm only wearing socks. That's no good. I need some nice shiny black boots so I can join in the sword play. Looking down at my legs, I attempt to materialize black boots around my feet, but I can't. Not even when I make an effort to imagine the solid feel of them around my ankles and against the soles of my feet. It's really upsetting me. Why can't I conjure some boots? And as I'm literally stomping one foot in frustration, I wake up. Chapter 15. Completely disregarding Simon's request that I limit personal texts on my new phone, the first thing I did when I woke up in the morning was text Steve. "I tried calling you on the phone in a lucid dream." To my delight, he replied almost immediately,
"That's great, but I didn't hear the phone ring."
I typed back, "A man's voice answered and said, 'Steve is not available at this time.'"
He replied, "LOL. Good morning, my dream girl. We'll talk later."
I wrote, "Okay, have a great day." Smiling, I turned off the phone, put it back on the nightstand, and then just sat up in bed, contentedly remembering my brothers and sisters in the dream. A psychoanalyst might theorize that I was compensating for the loneliness of being a single child, but I knew it was no coincidence the room my dream siblings had slept in resembled a church annex. Throwing off the covers, I hurried over to my Bible. I said softly,
"Good morning, Lord." And moved by the conviction his living word had something to tell me, I opened the book to where I was in Matthew, and then again much farther into the New Testament, to a place which at that moment, for some reason, seemed to be where I had to go. My eyes fell on this passage. "Brothers and sisters, always be full of joy in the Lord. I say it again, rejoice. Let everyone see that you are considerate in all you do. Remember, the Lord is coming soon. Don't worry about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God what you need and thank him for all he has done. Then you will experience God's peace, which exceeds anything we can understand. His peace will guard your hearts and minds as you live in Christ Jesus." Philippians 4:4-6. Picking up my dream journal, I copied what I had just read. Then I went and sat on the bed again, where I wrote down my lucid dream, which took me some time because I strove to write neatly and with as much accuracy and detail as possible, for otherwise I would fail to do justice to the incredible experience. Carol was at home. She had left with Simon and Steve yesterday evening in the Egyptologist's new car. As we sat talking at the table, Steve had told me that Simon had signed over his old Jeep to him. The problem was, he didn't have a parking permit yet, and might not even be able to get one where he lived now. He had said that an old Jeep wasn't about to make him go in a direction he didn't think was right by forcing him to accelerate his plans. Cherishing the hope I was a big part of those plans, I hadn't pressed him for details. I was just happy to have a dream job and a phone again. A phone, I now remembered, with which I had promised to email my parents about Steve. But I didn't have to do that right away. I could wait a day or two. I wanted to have some fun first, like catch up on all my social media apps. At some point during my new phone honeymoon in the living room, I wondered why Liba hadn't come to say hello earlier when I was still in my room, as she always did before retiring to the study to immerse herself in a book she was forbidden to read. I also hadn't heard her leave the study to use the bathroom yet. Setting my phone down, I got up and walked silently in my bare feet down the corridor to the last door on the left. For about a minute, I just stood there listening. But I heard not a sound coming from the room beyond. I could hear the refrigerator in the kitchen making ice, and the faint sounds of a city outside the double-paned windows, but otherwise the apartment was utterly still and silent. I waited for the faint rustling of a page being turned, in vain. Even before I gently gripped the knob and opened the door just enough to look into the room, I knew I would not see Liba sitting at the desk. In fact, the moment I realized I hadn't seen her that morning, my body had told me I was alone in the apartment. Even though it was full of books and furniture, how empty the room felt was almost frightening. Where was Liba? As far as I knew, she had been scheduled to come in this morning as usual. Maybe she had told Carol yesterday, before we left for the art museums, that she wouldn't be coming this morning. Closing the door again, I hurried back into the living room, where, thanking God I had a phone again, I texted Carol and asked her if this was Liba's day off. Not surprisingly, I didn't receive a response right away. I had no idea what she and Simon were up to. I could have gone back to what I had been doing, but I was no longer in the mood to play online. Suddenly finding myself with way too much time on my hands before anything interesting was scheduled to happen, I stood up and walked into the kitchen to consider what I'd have for lunch in a little while. But I wasn't hungry yet. I was uneasy, even nervous. Where was Liba? Why wasn't she here? Why was I so worried? Well, I could answer that last question, because reading the Bible was dangerous for her. And Steve and I were enabling her to do so, which according to Islamic law, made us guilty of a terrible crime. I was a criminal. If my parents found out about this, they would kill me. Still, I wished they were here now. Steve was right. I should ask them to come to Egypt for Christmas. there was a knocking at the front door. Although for half a second I knew it wasn't Liba. For one thing, she had a key, and even if she didn't, she wouldn't knock so impatiently. It was probably just the building's Boab come to deliver a bill or inform Carol of some scheduled maintenance. I said, "Coming," and opened the door a crack. I had just enough time to see it was Hamoud standing on the threshold before he pushed past me into the apartment. After taking a quick look around the living room, he disappeared into the kitchen. Maybe he had smoked too many cigarettes that morning and desperately needed a glass of water? But he emerged immediately, hands empty, and strode into the corridor leading to the bedrooms and the study. Oh, my God. Oh, thank God. Oh, God! I knew exactly what was happening now, but I couldn't believe it, so I couldn't think, and I just remained standing by the front door, leaving it open in the hope he would walk out as swiftly as he had barged in, because his youngest daughter wasn't here today reading my Bible. Thank you, God. When Hamoud reappeared, I grabbed hold of the doorknob again, but he simply stood there at the entrance to the living room, staring at me in a way that made me wonder why I had ever thought I knew him. Of course I didn't know him. He didn't drive Carol and I wherever we wanted to because he liked us. He was paid to do it. And although he seemed to like his job, that didn't mean he felt the same way about his passengers. And now all the times he had looked at me in the rearview mirror came back to me as he stared at me in a way that made me shamefully aware of the fact that I was still wearing only the sleeveless T-shirt I slept in. Suddenly he shouted,
"Ein Ibnetea!"
What? I seriously regretted not having learned more Arabic.
"Where is my daughter?"
I don't know. I was wondering that myself. I prayed he would hear the ring of truth in my voice and leave. I just wanted him to leave. It seemed I was going to get my wish, because he suddenly strode into the living room and, shoving me aside, slammed the door closed, but not behind him.
"Mary, please, tell me now where Liba is."
His polite tone didn't make me feel better, because his black eyes were so cold and hard. I suffered the impression I was being stared down at by a bird of prey that cared only about the well-being of its chick, and I was a threat to that goal, and he knew it. Forcing myself to hold his eyes, I said quietly, respectfully, "Hamoud, please believe me when I tell you that I really do not know where Liba is." The next thing I knew, I was studying the color and texture of a rug I was getting my first real good look at because one of my cheeks was resting against it. My other cheek was burning and hurt. Somewhere above me, I heard Hamoud speaking in a furious undertone that was somehow worse than shouting.
"You poison my daughter with your ideas and turn her against Allah. Now you can drive yourselves around, you slut who sleep with men before marriage. You can drive yourselves straight to El Jahimo. But first you tell me where Liba is."
By this point in his tirade, I was on my feet again, and feeling mysteriously detached from what was happening, as if it was a scene in a movie I was being forced to act in, while my soul looked on in a sort of curious wonder life could actually be so violently dramatic. And oddly enough, I had been more frightened before he slapped me, with such force I didn't even notice the trip down to the carpet. Now all my senses felt sharper and stronger than they ever had before. I cried, "How dare you!" And putting both hands on his chest, shoved him away from me. "Don't you dare touch me again!" I'm sure it was how surprised he was, and not my strength, that caused him to stagger back a few paces. And when he recovered his balance again, he stared at me in something like shock. I didn't wait to see how he would react. My body bolted like a rabbit from a momentarily dazed wolf straight into the bathroom, the first room I came to as I fled. I was closing the door behind me when he shoved it open, forcing me to back away from it as he entered. His eyes were not on my face now, but on my body, which he stared at with a disgust that bled disturbingly into lust. Slowly moving toward me, he said quietly,
"Liba is my sweetest little flower, and you are trying to steal her from me. You will tell me now where she is."
Why had I run in here? I should have run out the front door. Now I was trapped.
"Where is Liba?"
He was back to shouting.
"Where is my daughter?"
"I told you, Hamoud, I don't know." Once again, I time-traveled, but this trip happened a bit more slowly thanks to the shower curtain, which helped break my fall into the bathtub. Like a parachute, I abruptly found myself tangled in. I suspected my left arm would feel a lot worse right now if I wasn't, and that I might possibly be unconscious as well, because I had hit the back of my head pretty hard against the wall. After the split-second assessment of my condition, which was thankfully very good thanks to the angelic white wing of the shower curtain that had been torn off most of its rings but clung to a few crucial ones, I looked up and saw Hamoud standing by the sink, staring down at me with a dangerous look in his eyes. A male voice full of authority demanded,
"Have you lost your mind, man?"
"Saidi al-Mutarm."
Hamoud tried his best to bow while making way for the tall figure who stepped past him into the bathroom.
"You have returned."
"Wait for me downstairs, Hamoud. I will speak with you shortly. Now get out of here."
Hamoud fled. I wondered if I might be dreaming, because I had never seen this man before, but Hamoud obviously knew him. Whoever he was, I was very happy to see him, because he had made Hamoud go away, which meant it was safe to get out of the bathtub now, which turned out to be relatively easy, thanks to the stranger. First he asked me if I was hurt, and when I said only a little, but that I was fine, he lifted me tenderly up into his arms, carried me straight to the guest room, and lay me gently across the bed. It all felt real, the silky texture of his dark gray suit jacket, the pain in my left arm, and the dull ache at the back of my skull, but I still wasn't sure this wasn't a dream. Sitting down beside me on the edge of the bed, the stranger looked me over, his examination lingering on my left arm, which I now saw was bleeding and scraped in a few places. The bathtub was perfectly smooth, so the cuts must have been made by the metal hooks of the shower curtain when they snapped.
"You'll be fine,"
he said quietly. "Yes, but I'm still very glad you came when you did."
"Hamoud would have come to his senses," he assured me. "I imagine he's sorry now that he lost his temper and hurt you. Nevertheless, I will see to it he and his wife find employment elsewhere."
Realization finally dawned. "You're Matthew?"
"I am. And you must be Mary, Carol's dearest friend. Wait here a moment."
Rising, he left the room. I watched him walk down the hall to the bathroom. He returned with a bottle of hydrogen peroxide and a washcloth. Sitting down beside me again, he lightly wiped my cuts and abrasions, and the slight burning sensation felt almost mysteriously pleasurable as I studied his face. He spoke perfect English, but he wasn't an American. There was a subtle musical lilt to his speech, and the features of his face had an extremely distinguished look to them, as if his genes could be traced back to the same family for centuries. He wasn't a young man, but he was still in the prime of life, his hair a light brown, with a subtle silver sheen to it that made it hard to tell what color his eyes were, as one moment they looked brown, and the next, whenever he turned his head and the light caught them, I glimpsed green and golden highlights. When he was done tending to my thankfully minor wounds, he stood up again.
"Mary, I need to go speak with Hamoud now. Can I get you anything else before I go? I won't be long."
"No, thank you. I'm fine. But Hamoud is so upset because he can't find his daughter Liba. She's taking over for her mother for a few weeks. It's a long story, but the gist of it is that Liba dreamed of Jesus, and when she saw my Bible in my dream journal, she thought I had maybe dreamed of Jesus too, which I think I have. But the point is, she's reading the Bible now because Jesus told her to, and so I lent her mine the first day. But then Steve got her own smaller copy, which would be easier to hide. Only now she seems to be missing, and I'm worried, because I don't know where she is, and neither does her father. Steve told me he was putting her in touch with a Coptic priest who is helping other young Muslims like her who want to learn more about Christ and who are drawn to him, which, as I'm sure you know, is very dangerous for them. So I'm hoping she's with them today. But if she is, when she gets home...
I didn't even want to think about that. I understand, Mary. Don't worry. I will also get in touch with Steve now and tell him to find out if Liba is with this priest you mentioned, in which case she should stay where she is.
Of course. Matthew J. Waters was a friend of Simon's, and Steve was Simon's assistant, and Hamoud and Ozzy and now Liba all worked for him. He knew everyone involved. He had even known about me.
You have had a shock, Mary. Get some rest. I will be back soon.
Okay. As soon as he left the room, closing the door silently behind him, I got up, walked over to my Bible, opened it to somewhere in the Gospels, and these sentences written in red immediately leaped out at me.
Don't be afraid. Take courage. I am here.
Matthew 14:27. Chapter 16. I discovered that shock is a painkiller when it wore off, and what had happened hit me without its mysterious adrenaline-inflated cushion. My scratched, bruised, and sore left arm was a constant reminder of the unbelievable truth. Hamoud had behaved so violently toward me, he had knocked me off my feet not once but twice. Yet I was fine, and it was the smiling, cheerful, easy-to-get-along-with Hamoud who was gone forever. Never again would he drive Carol and I anywhere. And it was my fault, because there was no doubt I was guilty of encouraging his daughter to disobey him. But the superficial cartoon-like Hamoud I had carried around in my mind had never really existed. I couldn't stop remembering now all the times he had glanced at me in the rearview mirror that had made me uncomfortable, especially on the occasion when my stomach rumbled hungrily and he joked about American girls having big appetites. Combined with the way he had looked at me in the bathroom yesterday, this memory made me feel sick, almost to the point of wanting to throw up. I tried my best not to keep thinking about the events of yesterday morning, but they kept replaying in my head, and I couldn't find the stop button. I was only able to pause and slow down the action. It seemed incredible to me I had been brave enough to shove him away from me. I would never forget the surprise in his eyes. In retrospect, I was also surprised by my own stupidity. I had completely forgotten that I was in an Islamic country. But I hadn't known yesterday what I did today, thanks to Wiki Islam. Quote, wife beating in the Muslim world comes from the teachings of Islamic religious texts such as the Quran and the Hadiths. Because domestic violence has been used as a tool to maintain control and dominance over Muslim women, this has created an intensely patriarchal society where men rule women and women must submit to men, end quote. What I did manage to avoid thinking about was what might have happened if Matthew J. Waters hadn't shown up when he did. And then Steve had come. I had been almost as surprised to see him, until I remembered Matthew had told me he would be getting in touch with him. By then, I had felt myself to be fully recovered from the traumatic experience, and had been much more worried about Liba. It turns out that one of her sisters had discovered the Bible in her purse and shown it to her mother, who had threatened Liba with telling her father about it, at which point Liba had fled the house, going straight to the place Steve had told her to if she no longer felt safe at home. And she was still there, under the priest's protection, in a home full of young Muslims in similar positions. My relief was short-lived, however, because it seemed the worst had happened. I wondered what would become of her without her family's emotional and financial support, and felt sad for her mother and sisters, who I seriously doubted would be of much help in the face of Hamoud's righteous fury. Yet maybe as time passed, he would miss his youngest daughter, his little flower, as he had called her. Or maybe his little flower would wilt first, and return home and strive to forget all about her dream of Issa.
Don't worry about her,
Steve had urged me.
She's safe where she is, with the priest and other young people like her, in God's hands. Matthew also intends to help her however he can.
He's such an incredibly nice man. I can't believe he just showed up like that out of the blue, just at the right moment. His eyes on my injured arm, Steve said coldly.
A few minutes earlier would have been even better. Does your head hurt? I mean, do you have a headache?
He was sitting on the edge of the bed in the same spot Matthew had. No, I said. Don't worry. I liked how intensely handsome he looked when he was angry. A lock of black hair curling against his forehead made me realize he hadn't cut his hair since I met him. I fell into a little daydream then, thinking he would look even more like an original disciple of Christ if he let his hair grow. I considered asking him to, since I felt he would promise me anything in these moments. But just then I heard the front door slam closed. I sat bolt upright, afraid Hamoud had returned and was even angrier than before. Steve said so gently,
Mary, it's okay.
I felt 5 years old again, as I realized I was clinging to him.
It's only Carol. Hamoud won't be coming back.
What's going on here? Carol demanded from where she stood in the open doorway. Why didn't Liba show up? She didn't tell me she wasn't coming in today.
I'll explain everything in a minute, Steve replied. Mary needs to rest.
No, I don't. I slipped out of his arms. I need to eat. I'm hungry. Steve said quickly,
Carol, can you please go make us all some lunch?
What? She sounded stunned. You want me to fix lunch? I burst out laughing, which felt good. But that had been yesterday. Today, I was alone again and not feeling very comfortable with myself. I hadn't lied to Hamoud, not exactly. At the time, I'd really had no idea where Liba was. Of course, I could guess the reason for her sudden disappearance and where she might have gone, but if I had told Hamoud all that, the consequences might have been the same, maybe even worse. I would never know, and Steve, thank God, seemed able to guess how I'd be feeling, because every now and then he texted me, and what he said helped soothe my anxiety. My nerves were like a cat's arched back he stroked with just the right words, so that for a while I was able to relax. But that wasn't easy because I was full of restless energy and with no outlet for it except my new phone. But even that came with a price, because it kept reminding me that I was putting off writing my parents about Steve. Finally, I got sick of it and sent my mom a quick, terse, I preferred to think of it as casual, email telling her I thought it would be great if they came to Cairo for Christmas because I wanted to introduce them to someone very special. That was all I could manage, but it was better than nothing. Carol had offered to stay home with me, but knowing that she was missing out on a shopping spree with her fiancé, who had finally realized this was his last chance to contribute to the decor of his future home, would have made us both miserable. I consoled myself, planning a big gourmet dinner I hoped would assuage the irritation, to put it mildly. I imagined Simon was feeling toward Steve and I for giving Matthew cause to regret putting his apartment at our disposal, which had cost him his longtime housekeeper and chauffeur. I also found myself hoping the apartment's enigmatic and handsome owner would show up again unexpectedly, but I knew he wouldn't. Matthew had informed Steve, who later told me, that he had returned to Cairo for some important meeting but was leaving again in a few days. He was staying at a hotel and had dropped by his apartment to collect some items from his study. I wondered what opinion he had formed of me during our brief but dramatic acquaintance. I was feeling embarrassed now. I was pretty stupid for not knowing better than to challenge a Muslim man who had every right to be upset to a shoving duel. But Hamoud had hit me first, and with such force he had knocked me off my feet. I had to keep reminding myself the whole ugly incident had not been my fault. Where I came from, people were free to read whatever they wanted to. It was funny how intensely aware I was now of that dark room at the end of the corridor, Matthew's study. I felt drawn to it, which made no sense. So I ended up actively avoiding my desire to open the closed door and not only look into it, as I had yesterday, but enter it. And do what? Explore it like a heroine in a gothic novel searching for some fascinating secret? Matthew had